I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Stephen Strogatz. He's a professor of applied mathematics at Cornell University. He's the author of several books, including Sync, The Calculus of Friendship, and The Joy of X. He will be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater on The Joy of X, a guided tour of math sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much, Mary Charlotte. I'm thrilled to be here.
So let's talk for a moment about applied mathematics. What are the applications that you do in applied mathematics?
Well, there's a whole range of things. My own interest started mainly with applying math to biology. I was encouraged by my parents at some point in college to be pre-med. They sort of used to say to me, like, what are you going to do with math? You know, that... But at least if you're a doctor, you know, you'll have a good living. And my mother actually, who didn't go to college, you know, didn't have a very sophisticated view of what was possible for a person with math training. But she said I had nice hands, so she thought that made me a, you know, good candidate for a doctor. Anyway, so like a dutiful son, I took pre-med courses. And at one point, I learned about DNA and the double helix. And we all hear about the double helix, but to me, it was a geometrical thing. This shape encoded one of the key mysteries of life, which is how is it that you look like your parents? And it's right there in the geometry that one strand of DNA matches up with the other, that the shape of the molecule tells you how it's going to work. And so I thought that was fantastic and spent much of my early part of my career working on the hidden math in biology. My PhD was about our sleep cycles. Which, again, my mother wondered, you know, I thought you liked math. Why are you studying sleep? And that was the point, that people who studied sleep hadn't really done much math about it, yet there's profound mathematical patterns in our rhythms of sleep and wake and our circadian rhythms of body temperature and hormone fluctuations and all the rest. So that was the beginning for me, but then there's applications of math to everything. Social science is one of my favorites nowadays.
Well, that's something that I think is really interesting to talk about, is that math underlies virtually all the sciences. I mean, physics, obviously, you can talk about DNA, but so many things where we wouldn't think that it applies.
Yes. To me, that's where a lot of the most fun and the fresh opportunities come, is when you look at something that seems like math has nothing to do with it. If you're a believer that math has to do with everything, then you can find the hidden math and the hidden patterns, which it gives a lot of creative opportunities, but it also provides scientific opportunities to reveal structure that may not have been noticed before. And sometimes you find commonalities between one subject and another, which that is to say, like here at Santa Fe Institute, where, you know, who's hosting this lecture that I'm giving tonight, that's a big theme of the Institute's work, is to see universal threads linking things that you wouldn't think were connected, like, say, how an ecosystem behaves and how an economy behaves, that there are individuals fighting for their life in both, and sometimes you see unexpected cooperation emerging, even though you would think that it's wickedly competitive.
And I think what's interesting about that is when you look at where the math lines up and where it doesn't, it can tell you a lot about each thing.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That sometimes the math gives you a certain amount of insight, but then there are other things that don't follow from the math. And that's something that our biological colleagues love to emphasize, the diversity of life, that is, the universal laws that we find only go so far. There's particularities about certain organisms or their niches that you really can't just say this all follows from the math. You have to do a deep study of the biology itself or those creatures. And that's fine too. I mean, it's nice in that there are kind of two types of people who like to go into math or science. Some are happy when they can say everything is the same. You know, those are the unifiers. And then there are others who are the diversifiers who like to say nothing is the same. Everything has its unique wonderful characteristics, and that's what they're sort of, I mean, disparagingly called by the unifiers, they're called the stamp collectors. You know, they want all the different stamps from all the different parts of the scientific world. Anyway, we need both types of thinking in science.
It's funny because the same thing happens in studies of cultures.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who like to say all human civilizations and cultures really have so many common themes, and others say, no, look at how different they are.
Exactly. And the truth has to be both, and you need both impulses to really get at the truth.
Now, we're talking about how underlying so much of the natural world is math in one way or another, but looking at it from the other side, does all math eventually have real-world applications?
That's an interesting question. The short answer, I would say, is yes. They do. It's just history has shown that every mathematical idea that we can dream up seems to find a counterpart in the real world. And it's something very philosophically puzzling. That is, it doesn't have to be that way. And yet, it often seems like it turns out that way. So people have written, there's a famous essay by a physicist, Eugene Wigner, with the phrase, the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the natural sciences. The unreasonable being the key word. Why should it be that math, which we can, you know, I mean, in math, we're allowed to dream up anything we want as long as it doesn't violate logic. If it, that is, you can make any definitions, any rules, and then extract the consequences of those rules, and then you're playing the game of math. But why should it be that in nature, or in our bodies, or in our societies, or in the universe, there's something that follows those rules? It's probably too, it'd be an exaggeration to say everything we can think of mathematically has a real world instantiation. That would be going too far, I think. But it's not way too far. I mean, just about every beautiful thing we've thought of at some point turns out to be out there in the world. And we don't really exactly know why. This idea that the world often manifests math is not always a happy thought for mathematicians. That is, there was a time, I'm thinking of World War I, one of the worst, maybe the worst war of all time in terms of, you know, human suffering and death, and just a really horrific war. And there were generations of mathematicians who felt somewhat complicit. That is, they had helped come up with, say, calculating the trajectories for cannons or, you know, ballistics. That is, mathematicians played a part in the death and destruction of World War I. And in reaction to that, some of them wanted to do math that would never be used in any evil way ever again. And one of them, a British mathematician named Hardy, worked in the area that he thought was the most rarefied and hence the safest from real-world applications, which was number theory, just the study of numbers and their properties. Fast forward a few decades, and number theory is now the basis for cryptography, for secret codes, and for all the surveillance that's happening to all of us right now. So even his most pristine branch of math has turned out to not be, you know, immune from this kind of potential ugly application. But then I guess you have to say, to balance it, that it also may have life-saving or beautiful applications too. So it's hard to tell. Anyway, we're sort of stuck with this reality that math keeps turning out to be useful both for good and bad.
Are there any concepts in math that contradict each other?
I wouldn't say that we have any mathematical concepts that contradict each other, but we certainly do have tension in math, that there can be a tension between one way of thinking and another. That's often a productive and creative tension. I'm thinking, for example, of algebra versus geometry. That is, you can think symbolically, that's the essence of algebra, or you can think visually, which is geometric, and there have been times in history when one way of thinking dominated, sometimes in almost a political sense, to the suppression of the other way of thinking. The more intuitive geometric way of thinking often leads to great discoveries, but sometimes it leads to, it's almost like when we talk about right brain, left brain. It's a little bit like that the right-brainedness of visual thinking can lead to fantastic imaginative leaps, but sometimes it looks a little sloppy to the people who are the algebraic thinkers, and then they feel that math needs to be sort of cleaned up and tightened up, and then you go through waves of, or even generations of algebraic mopping up work. They wouldn't call it that, I mean, you can probably tell where my sympathy lies, that I like the visual side of math.
So it's really, there's different kinds of people who tend toward different ways of thinking, visual mm-hmm. thinkers or...
Sometimes. And there are also some people who are good at both. There's a lot of room for all personality types and tastes.
Yeah, in math.
It's a big tent.
Now, let's talk for a moment about the beauty of math and representing things symbolically and visually. Does every mathematical concept have a visual representation?
I don't know what I would say to that. My first thought would be to say, yes, it does. But then again, that's probably not true. I think there are some things that really are very distant from geometry. I'm thinking of just, say, the rules of logic themselves. You know, you may remember those old jokes about, like, I don't know, syllogisms. The usual one they say is every person is mortal. Socrates was a person. Therefore, whatever. I mean, I don't see any way to visualize that. It's just pure logic. I don't know. You may have gotten me with that one. I have to think about it. I mean, to me, there's no necessary rule that everything has to be geometrizable.
I was thinking that only because of my own... I mean, I loved math in high school, and especially loved geometry and all the ways that you could... I guess I'm probably... in math, more of the visual type. Like if I could see it in my mind, mm-hmm. that was good. And then when it got to college and calculus and I couldn't see it anymore, mm-hmm. I wasn't interested and just dropped it.
Well, that's a pity because calculus is one of the most visual.
I know. I just didn't.
Yeah. That may have just been a case of the way it was taught to you. I mean, it is often taught as a matter of manipulating lots of formulas, the jargon being derivatives and integrals and lots of symbols across the page. But all of that absolutely is tied to our intuitions about things moving around, things changing. And I mean, I'm using the vague word things because it could be anything. It could be populations of people or creatures. It could be baseballs zigzagging through the air. It could be anything. The planets moving around in the solar system. Calculus really is probably the most powerful part of math, which is why so often in pop culture we think of it as the pinnacle of learning. On the other hand, to the professionals, calculus is the very beginning. I mean, you know, that's the first course we teach in college, really. So it's just the gateway.
Right. Now, is getting back to something I was thinking about asking you before, is all math, I mean, at a certain point, in every generation, there are discoveries in math or there are new breakthroughs in math. And when there are breakthroughs, are they discoveries of something that's already there as we might discover something in nature? Are they human inventions?
Mm-hmm. That's one that you can get people into fistfights over that question.
Really?
That's a big contentious issue in the philosophy of math. There are, you articulated, there are sort of these two camps that some people see it as a human creation, which it certainly is. That is, we're inventing the definitions, we're inventing the symbols. We may even be inventing the rules of logic themselves, that are the rules of the game. We don't really know, that is, in an experimental sense, we can't ask lobsters or dogs what math looks like to them, and we haven't met the aliens, you know, from outer space yet. So we don't really know if it's possible that there could be other types of math. Actually, we do have some experiments on Earth itself where you can look at how the ancient Chinese did math when they were not in communication with the ancient Greeks. You know, like, does math look different in those different civilizations? And some aspects of it look different, but the facts don't look different. The theorems are the same. So... the short answer, I guess, to that I would give is that we do invent the concepts and the definitions, but we discover the consequences. That is, I want it both ways. It's both invention and discovery. The truths of mathematics, the consequences, that is, the theorems, are discoveries, I would say. They're out there, waiting to be discovered. But how we get to them and what questions we ask... and what techniques we use, I think we're inventing those.
Right.
If you treat it as a sociological question and ask mathematicians, what do they think the answer is, invented or discovered? I would say it's that the vast majority of working mathematicians would say that it's discovered. You really have the sensation when you're working on something that the answer is waiting for you, and that it's behind a veil, and it's your job to somehow seduce the problem into revealing itself. It feels like that. Now, that's not all, you know, I'm not proving anything by saying that, but it doesn't feel like you've made up the answer in the way that Beethoven really did make the Fifth Symphony. I don't think he discovered the Fifth Symphony. He created it. To a professional mathematician, it doesn't feel like that. It feels like you're discovering it.
We're talking to mathematician Stephen Strogatz. I do wonder, and I don't think we can really get into it, but I do find myself wondering if you got some really top-level artists and mathematicians together to talk about their experience of working, whether there would be some common ground.
Well, yeah, that would be a fascinating discussion to have, because I said it very matter-of-factly that say in music, you're not discovering, you're creating. But then again, if there were a musician here in the room, for I don't know, maybe you do music, I don't really, but there may be some musicians out there or composers who feel like when they hit the right sequence of notes or find a theme, a perfect melody, that it was waiting for them in the same way.
Yeah.
So I could imagine that.
The neuroscientist Oliver Sacks, who wrote all those books, and I think the first one that I came across was The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. And in that book, there were these two twins who were basically, they were very low IQ, couldn't take care of themselves, lived in a halfway house or something, but they both were tuned into prime numbers, and they would sit there and recite prime numbers to each other, and they were, in fact, prime numbers. And it just, like, that really was one of the change my whole mind about what math is stories, because it's like, the prime numbers have a character and a quality that is there to be somehow enjoyed on an aesthetic level by people who are in tune with that.
Yes.
It's crazy.
It's true. It's a very interesting story about those twins. Yeah, there are other calculating prodigies and savants who, I mean, there's a story of a taxi driver who, when he would look at license plates and then factor the number that he saw on the license plate into its prime factors. And he would enjoy particularly big, you know, license plates with lots of numbers and not many letters, so that the factoring would be more difficult. For people who aren't used to thinking about prime numbers, maybe I should say just briefly why it is that mathematicians are always talking about them and obsessing about them. If you think about, okay, just as a reminder, a prime number means a number that, a whole number that you can't divide by any number except for one and itself. So something like 13 is indivisible, whereas 12, you know, is a very divisible number. It's divided by 1, 2, 3, and 4. So that's a very sort of compliant number, ready to be divided and chopped up into smaller bits. And in that sense, the prime numbers are recalcitrant. They are sort of stubborn and rigid and indecomposable. They're sort of like atoms. That is, to a chemist, the atoms, or really the elements, are special because they're elementary. They cannot be divided. They're the building blocks of everything else. So if you ask what are the building blocks of multiplication, they're the prime numbers. And so for us, studying the prime numbers and their properties is sort of like a chemist wanting to understand the periodic table. It's fundamental.
And how do you use them? How do you study them?
Well, the big question, I mean, there are many questions about prime numbers, but one of the really disturbing ones is that we don't know how to predict them. This seems really strange because, on the one hand, they should be totally predictable. There's nothing random about them. There's no chance involved. You can, with a computer or just by hand, you know, decide whether a number is prime or not by trying all the numbers less than it. Does it divide in or not? I mean, there's no great mystery in a way about whether a given number is prime. But if you look for a pattern among the prime numbers as a whole, as a family, you start to notice some funny things about them, like what's the space between them? So, for instance, let's just do a few small numbers. Okay, 11 is prime, 13 is prime. There's a gap of 2. That's the smallest possible gap. Now, what's the next one? So 13, now 15 is not prime, right? That's divisible by 5. So then we have to go up to 17. So now we have a bigger gap of 4, 13 to 17, gap of 4. But then 19 is only 2 away. So what's going on? I mean, it went 2, 4, 2. As, if you start to look at the gaps between prime numbers, they're certainly not, you know, that's the thing. It's not easy to figure out a rule for the gaps. And no one has ever figured out a rule for the gaps. But we have approximate rules that seem to work pretty well. And, you know, I mean, for small numbers like the ones I just said, it's not that tough. But as you start getting out to numbers with many, many digits, it turns out that one of the dreaded concepts from high school math, the logarithm, which a lot of kids learned and then thought, what the heck did I learn that for? It turns out that logarithms are intimately tied into the question of how the prime numbers are spaced. And they're not spaced according to any rule that we know. They almost behave in some ways like they are random, even though just a minute ago I said they're not random. So it's this funny mix of randomness and pattern and almost indecipherability, except that they're on the just on the edge of what we can understand. We have learned things about the prime. So I don't know. I mean, they actually have inspired people in Hollywood. There's a slightly cheesy movie that Barbara Streisand, it was really a vehicle for her, Barbara Streisand and Jeff Bridges did some years ago called The Mirror Has Two Faces, where Jeff Bridges is a nerdy math professor and Barbara Streisand is supposed to be an ugly duckling English professor. And she has a gorgeous sister who, you know, the mother always says, why can't you be beautiful like your sister? And anyway, of course, it ends up being a love story between these two. And Barbara Streisand learns from Jeff Bridges about a certain kind of prime numbers that are called twin primes, which are primes that are as close as two primes can be, separated by two, like 17 and 19. And
well, close, really as close can be 2 and 3.
Oh, good one. Yes, 2 is a very special prime number. It's the only even prime number. So you're right. You got me. But mathematically, we don't. 2 is very exceptional. It's, as I say, it's the only even prime number. So I guess I should say, among all the non-even prime numbers, 2 is the closest that they can be.
Once you get off your left hand where you started counting.
Yeah, very good. But anyway, so Barbara Streisand asked Jeff Bridges in the course of the movie, when they're just falling in love, do these prime numbers go on forever? The twin primes, these sort of romantic ones that are trying to snuggle as close as two primes can get, can they just keep going? Like, do we ever run out of them, or do they go all the way out to infinity? And Jeff Bridges' character just about falls off his chair at that point because he says that is precisely what we don't know. And we still don't know. Even today, we don't know whether the twin primes are infinite. Are there infinitely many of them, or do we at some point, is there a last pair, sort of like way out in the darkness, trying to hold on to each other, and they're the last ones? We don't know. That's the twin prime conjecture. The twin prime conjecture, I should say, is that they do go on forever, but they become increasingly sparse. And so if you picture them as sort of like standing along this lonesome highway going out to infinity, you know, you have to go farther and farther before you see the next pair.
And they seem like they should be a metaphor for something human.
Yes, they do. And there's a beautiful novel about that, an Italian novel called The Solitude of Prime Numbers. And it's been translated into English, and it's very haunting. I would recommend it for people who want to, you know, it's a pretty dark story of two teenagers who are both misfits in their own way. Each of them has a lot of problems, but they find each other and they sort of try to have a romance, but because of the problems that each one has, they can never quite get close enough to touch like the twin primes.
Very interesting. We talk about, or mathematicians sometimes talk about, and scientists too, of a proof of something being elegant. And then you might say that somebody's living room is elegant. Do those uses of the word have anything to do with each other?
Well, I think I know what it means in math for something to be elegant. I'm not so sure what we would mean by a living room.
Or a suit or a pair of shoes,
yeah.
Or, you know.
Well, no, it's a nice question. I mean, maybe they have something to do with each other. In math, elegant means, well, usually it involves something minimal, that is something that's very ornate and over-embellished. We wouldn't call elegant. Elegant, I think of as having a kind of simplicity to it. And usually it means that, you know, you'd say a proof is elegant if it gives you a very satisfying sense of, aha, I understand it now. That is, it doesn't just convince you or bludgeon you into believing that a result is true. It opens your eyes to why it's true. That you have a feeling of revelation when you read an elegant proof. Now, how would that compare to an elegant ballerina or an elegant suit? I don't know. I mean, I usually think of elegance in the arts as having to do with a kind of minimalism, but that may not be true. I mean, it's very subjective, right? What's elegant to one person may not be to someone else. Do you want to weigh in? What would you say is elegant?
I don't know. I mean, when you say over-embellished in a mathematical proof, you think of some kind of like crazy, overly ornate, late Baroque, Rococo,
yes,
and that's not
that's what I
really
mean.
Elegant.
That's not. I'm going to say that's not elegant. I, you know, I'm pretty, like, so let's shift it to sports for a second. Both Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal are great champions, but I would say only one of them is elegant. I don't know if you watch tennis, but when you watch Roger Federer play, he looks like he's floating on the court. There's no wasted effort. Everything is, and that's what I'm talking about with the minimalism. Everything looks easy. To me, he's an elegant player. Rafael Nadal is a very muscular player who looks like he overpowers his opponents through sheer strength and willpower and speed, but he's always injuring himself. You know, Federer almost never injures himself. It's just they're very different styles. And you can have math proofs that look like Nadal and math proofs that look like Federer. And we tend to prefer the Federer look. I don't know if other people would agree with this characterization.
And we have to grudgingly admit that they both win.
Of course, they both win, and there are two different ways to succeed. And, you know, what often happens, actually, in the history of math is that the first breakthrough will be in the Nadal style. That is, you do whatever it takes to get the result. Actually, Picasso has a quote along those lines in art that a really I don't have the exact quote, but it's something like a genuine breakthrough or a genuine innovation in art. The first creation is never pretty. Then it gets prettied up later by the people who follow. But real creation is often an ugly, messy affair. So, yeah, you need both styles.
Now, you are very much not only a mathematician, but a communicator about math. You've written various books for the public and are passionate about math education. And there's so much phobia and anxiety and also just non-interest in math. What's in it for ordinary people to break through that and develop a more of a connection with math?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a few different things that people could gain. The first is the satisfaction of understanding things. You know, kids often ask, when am I ever going to use this? That's an important question. And the honest answer is one that we rarely give them. The honest answer is you're not going to use it. Unless you're an engineer or in high tech maybe that's part of the positive way of putting the answer. Many of today's most exciting jobs require some facility with math. And I think everyone knows that. But suppose you already know that you're not going to be a computer programmer or work as an aeronautical engineer. Why does that person need math? And I think the honest answer to that person is you don't need math. That's true. The standard answers that you hear are, oh, it's good exercise. It'll train your mind. You know, it's like doing calisthenics. That is, there's no world championship of push-ups, but push-ups make you strong. So doing geometry will help you think logically. Doing algebra will help you get organized, blah, blah, blah. I don't like this answer because, you know, I don't find it very inspirational.
Yeah, so, right. Calisthenics. Oh, boy.
Yeah. And secondly, to me, it's insulting to math. That is to say, math is just calisthenics. We all agree it's pointless except to make your brain stronger. That's a misunderstanding of what math is. I think a better analogy would be to say to someone who says, why do I need music? Well, you don't need music. You could live your whole life never listening to music, never enjoying music. You could do that, and you could have a meaningful life, but you'd be missing something. I feel like that about math, that people who don't get math, which, as you say, is most people, they're missing something. Now, you might say, well, so what? Like, in my case, personally, I don't really get opera. You know, there are people I know who love opera. It makes them cry. It's really moving for them. I have never learned enough about opera to appreciate it. So what? You know, I mean, so I'm missing something. Is it like, it's not life-threatening for me. I can survive. It's just one more beautiful thing. So there's that, you know, that by opening up math to people, they can enrich their lives in one more way. But if that's not enough of an answer, I mean, maybe we should also say one other thing, which is that math is truly important in the sense that it has changed the world. You know, like this conversation we're having right now that uses electronics, the basis for electronics ultimately came from our mathematical understanding of electricity and magnetism and how electrons flow through materials and so on. And you know, I could give 100 examples. So there's something fundamentally important about math in the history of humanity, which if you don't get that, again, you're missing something. Can I also say that it's fun? I mean, aside from eating your vegetables and all that, people do, as little kids and also sometimes as grown-ups, like to solve puzzles. There are people who want to do crossword puzzle, not because it's useful, but because it's fun. You know, not just because it improves their vocabulary, but because they want to solve the puzzle. And there's that whole side of math, that it is just fun. And little kids know that. But then it somehow gets drummed out of them with, this, I don't know, the standardized testing, the pressure, the humiliation of, you know, the teacher saying that's wrong. And it's got this very black and white right or wrong character to it. So there's many things that can be a turnoff about math. We get that. But there's also a lot of really very uplifting and happy things if it's presented the right way.
And for our listeners, if they would like more, they can go to the New York Times and find a series of columns that you did. Just look under Stephen Strogatz. Stephen Strogatz is professor of applied mathematics at Cornell University. He will be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater on The Joy of X, A Guided Tour of Math, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. You can find out more at santafe.edu. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.